overall, the benefit of participating in this program over the summer was really expanding the scope of how I was thinking about this question and what data sources I was thinking about using. So it really felt like a privilege to get to work with people from a number of different disciplines, you know, psychology, economics, people who are really, really strong in methods. Because I got to leverage people from so many different backgrounds and disciplines rather than just my sort of niche policy area and the world I come from and how I've been trained.
I'm JB Wogan from Mathematica, and welcome back to On the Evidence. Every year, early career scholars join Mathematica in the summer to work on independent research related to improving public well-being. The deadline to submit applications for this year's summer fellowship program is February 28th. And so, as people weigh whether to throw their hats in the ring, I spoke with Jen Kirk, Katie Engel, and Adrian Jones, who participated in last year's summer fellowship program. Jen is pursuing a doctoral degree in gerontology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Her research examines racial and ethnic disparities in the screening and treatment of osteoporosis. Katie is pursuing a doctoral degree in public administration and policy at American University. Her research explores the effects of federal nutrition assistance on mental health. And Adrian is pursuing a joint doctoral degree in public policy and sociology at Duke University. Her research looks at how suspending people's driver's licenses may impede self-sufficiency. During our interview, we spoke about their experiences working with Mathematica staff, the policy implications of their research, why they're interested in applied research, and what they plan to do after defending their dissertations. A full transcript of the episode is available in our show notes and on a blog at mathematica.org. I hope you find our conversation useful. All right. So I think, first of all, I'm really excited to talk to everyone today and to hear a little bit more about your experiences with the Summer Fellowship and your work in general. I wanted to start by asking about kind of the backstory, the inspiration for getting into policy research. And I wondered, is there someone whose work in policy research has inspired you? Jen, do you want to go first? Is there kind of a policy research hero who guides your work or inspires your work?
This was kind of a hard question for me, only because it wasn't exactly a person, but it was more an organization. So prior to grad school, I got to work as a policy research summer fellow for Unidos US, and they do some work with Hispanic and Latinos throughout the country. Specifically with them, I got to work on this project called La Puerta de Oro, means the golden door. And so it was an adult day center. So essentially, if you have a loved one that's aging that needs care during the day, there's not very many ways to have that covered. And so when thinking about organizations that are advocating for programs like this or doing research on how to increase coverage and reduce health disparities, Unidos US is definitely one of those, as well as, of course, Mathematica. So it was hard to pick a specific person because there are so many. But if I had to pick something, Unidos US would be the one.
I didn't intend to start with a hard-hitting question, but that's great. It doesn't have to be a person. I think an organization works great too. Katie, what about you? Is there someone or some organization who's inspired your work?
Yeah, I guess I first got into SNAP research because I did a summer AmeriCorps program when I was in college, where I worked at a farmer's market in Rochester, New York, doing SNAP implementation at the market, essentially, so that residents could come and use their SNAP benefits at the market. So that's really what got me interested in the food and nutrition research in particular. And then I just sort of dived into the academic literature and became familiar with, you know, all the big names, Marion Bittler, Hilary Hoynsday and Sean Zabach, and got really interested in how increasing household resources through SNAP not only affects nutrition, but all these other outcomes that we care about as well as far as family well-being. So yeah, those are some of the researchers whose work I really admire and got me interested in the topic to begin with.
Okay, Katie, that's perfect. So Adrian, now I want to turn to you. Is there a person or an organization who has inspired you to go down this path of policy research?
Yeah, of course. So I think most recently, Dr. Alexis Harris at the University of Washington, and I really admire, she's a sociologist, kind of in the same way that I'm training to be, and I really appreciate how she uses kind of sociological tools to really examine some of these important and meaningful social problems. So in particular, I've been really excited to engage with her work around monetary sanctions because it's quite related to my dissertation work. I just think her work is really thoughtful, but it's also been a great resource for me as I've been developing my dissertation project. So reading her book and some of her papers and some of these special issue journals that she's been working on has been super informative for me.
Okay, and not everyone might be familiar with the phrase monetary sanctions. Is that it sounds like it's financial penalties or having to pay money? But yeah, is there more to say than that?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So they tend to be kind of fines and fees that are levied for a variety of infractions. So from everything from felony and misdemeanor offenses to like minor traffic charges, but they're penalties or punishments of sorts in financial form that are often levied on folks.
Okay, and the subject of the sentence when we're talking about, you know, blank is conferring monetary sanctions on somebody else. It's the government. It's a government agency. Is that usually the subject of the research?
Yeah, so it's typically the criminal legal system. So for an example, like I was driving down Highway 85 and I was speeding and I was pulled over by a state trooper and I received a ticket or like a citation for speeding. But that citation also comes along with like $100 fine that I have to pay to a local court system or jurisdiction or something like that.
Okay. But it would be different from, say, like a bank requiring, you're late paying a bill and or is that another kind of monetary sanction?
I mean, definitely it's another type of monetary sanction, but those that I'm working on for my dissertation are generally imposed by like the criminal legal system for some type of infraction that folks have experienced.
Okay, great. And then you mentioned that she has a book that was particularly influential on you. What's the name of that book?
Yeah, the book is called A Pound of Flesh, I believe. And it's just kind of, broadly exploring this issue of monetary sanctions. And some of the different chapters from that were really useful. I've been spending a lot of time reading her work, just kind of preparing myself to even think about how my work might be useful or contribute to some of the literature.
Okay, great. So we've talked about who or which organization inspired you all to go down the path of policy research. The other question I had was, why applied research? I mean, there are things you can do in academia, really interesting questions you can investigate, but all three of you did the summer fellowship at an organization that is trying to generate evidence that can influence systems, policies, programs, practices, change decision makers, improve people's lives for the better. What was it about applied research that appealed to you? And Katie, maybe we can start with you this time.
Sure. Yeah. I guess growing up, going way back, I always knew I kind of wanted to work on big social inequalities and those sort of issues. And I kind of thought I wanted to do more like boots on the ground work, nonprofit work, things like that. And then I realized that sort of my personality and interests were really suited to research because, I'm an introvert and I love sort of the puzzle solving nature of research, all the methods and the math. So I think doing the applied research sort of merged my interest with the methods, the math, the puzzles, and also this interest in social justice that I kind of always had.
Jen, what about you? What brought you down this path of applied research?
Similar in some ways to what Katie said about boots on the ground. So when I think about applied research, I think about well, how it differs from the other kinds of research and what my background is. So I started out by working in organizations at like the bottom ground level, and often would see that sometimes when speaking to management and policies were coming out, the policies didn't always fit how we were interacting with clients. So specifically in this situation, it was children with like autism that I was working with. So there seemed to be like a mismatch. Initially, I thought I wanted to do clinical research or just clinical work. And that didn't really allow me to kind of be this go-between person between the boots on the ground and the people who are higher up and making the policy. So when I think about applied research in terms of health disparities and what my work will contribute to, it's hopefully providing this like foundation of evidence that will help the policymakers make decisions that will actually create policies that are effective rather than sometimes a little bit of a mismatch there. So that's where I'm really inspired by this type of research.
All right, Adrian, now I think you're a first in our podcast recordings about previous summer fellows in the sense that you have actually worked at Mathematica before. You had a job here before going to get your PhD. So you'd already had some experience in applied research, but nonetheless, I'm interested with both in terms of why you had that previous position here and also doing this summer fellowship now. What is it about applied research that you like?
So I'm a person who's really interested in the so what questions. I think research is awesome, and I really enjoy creating knowledge. But once we've generated this new knowledge, I'm always thinking about like, so what does this mean? What do we do with this? And I think applied research really allows me to answer the so what question. I mean, the so what question is big, right? So there are a lot of different factors that go into what do we do with this? But I think my research is a part of starting to answer that so what question. So with regard to my work on these fines and fees in particular, we are learning some things from this project about the way they affect individuals and how they shape people's lived experiences here in the world. So my goal is to take this information and say, okay, so what then? Like, are fines and fees good for individuals? Are they good for society? If yes or if no, how might we think about kind of transforming these systems in ways that allow them to be more productive and less punitive? So I really like that kind of work, right? I really like partnering with local government agencies, community partners, even individuals in the communities think about some of the policies and procedures that we have and if they're working and if they're not, and how do we take that knowledge that we've generated and move forward in some productive way.
Okay, so we've talked in more general terms about what inspired each of you to go into policy research and what was it about applied research in particular that attracted you to this summer fellowship. I think now it'd be worth getting a little bit more into the details about your respective summer fellowship projects and how they fit into the larger context of your research, your dissertation. Katie, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, so my dissertation focuses broadly on socioeconomic disparities and well-being and the role of SNAP, for those who aren't familiar with the program. It's essentially the modern day version of the food stamp program, on mitigating those disparities. And so while at Mathematica, I focused on a SNAP pandemic policy change that essentially made it easier for people to maintain their SNAP participation status. It made sort of the administrative burden of the program much less. And during the pandemic, this policy sort of turned off in states in a staggered fashion. So basically in this project, I exploit the turn off of that policy where it then becomes harder to be a SNAP participant and look at how that policy change affects participants' mental health. So essentially it's leveraging a recent pandemic SNAP policy change to see how anxiety, depression are related to SNAP participation.
Okay, and then I'll turn to you, Adrian. Tell us a little bit more about your summer fellowship and how the work there fits into your dissertation work.
So my dissertation project is around driver's license suspensions and how they structure opportunities for mobility. So this is a qualitative investigation. So to kind of explore my research question, I collected interview data from individuals in North Carolina who were eligible for a local driver's license restoration program. And as far as my time at Mathematica, I spent the summer kind of analyzing my transcript data, trying to make sense of like the lived experiences of these unlicensed folks that we've been talking to.
Okay. Now, Jen, I want to turn to you. What was your summer fellowship about and how does it fit into your dissertation?
Yeah. So broadly, my dissertation is looking at racial and ethnic disparities in osteoporosis management in the United States. Osteoporosis, if you don't know what it is, it's a bone health disease that tends to be more common as individuals age. So there's a lot of fractures that are going to happen. So that means half of all women that are older women are going to experience a fracture. But even after a fracture, they're not experiencing treatment. So with knowing that not many people experience treatment and the sources of disparities in care in this country being things like social and structural factors, discrimination, and sometimes even mistrust of healthcare providers among racial and ethnic minorities, that's where my work fit in with some of Mathematica's work. So while a fellow at Mathematica, I worked on the aim of my dissertation that is looking at providers and how providers' decisions to treat or not treat may be influencing some of these racial and ethnic disparities in treatment. So I worked on a survey, developed it, came up with a sampling plan so it could be nationally representative so that hopefully in the end, this work will have the ability to have some policy implications on the provider level, the neighborhood level, and the individual level.
Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about the policy implications of your work. What should the policymaking community know about your research and perhaps research findings if you feel like you're ready to share those? Katie, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah, I can speak a little bit to both. The findings are still pretty preliminary, but essentially I find null effects, so no effect of SNAP participation on mental health. And, you know, traditionally people think null effects are kind of boring, but I think in this context, it's really important to note that, right? Because we know that SNAP is a really effective anti-poverty tool and food insecurity mitigation tool. It actually lifts more people out of deep poverty than any other means-tested program. And during the pandemic specifically, we saw that SNAP was really effective in mitigating food insecurity and helping increase these household resources. So I think my research is sort of in conversation with some of these other research projects that took place showing these effects during the pandemic, because it essentially shows that SNAP can achieve these aims without inducing some of the harmful things that you hear are political reasons tossed around for limiting the expansion of the program, like loss of autonomy, sort of this welfare dependency, this stigma, right? So it's basically, my research is basically in conversation with these other projects showing, hey, SNAP is a really effective social safety net tool, and we can't see any evidence that it's having the sort of this negative welfare stigmatization effect.
Do you think that might influence a decision about making SNAP more widely available, or should it be reinforcing the status quo? I mean, what might that mean for a policymaker who's trying to decide whether to make changes to the SNAP program?
Yeah, I think sort of another stream of literature that this project touches on is this whole administrative burden literature, right? So we know, for instance, that a lot of these social safety net programs are really hard to obtain and maintain your participation in, because there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through, and it's sort of a hassle, and there's a lot of different procedural barriers in gaining and maintaining participation. And because SNAP is administered at the state level, we see a lot of variation between states about the level of burdens that participants face when they participate in these programs. So I think this research is also sort of contributing to that discussion. I'm not sort of confident yet enough in my findings to say which way. But I think it's an important addition to that conversation of, hey, we looked at a SNAP, an onerous SNAP policy change, and we found that turning it off or turning it on doesn't really seem to have an effect on participant mental health, at least in this context. So I think in policymakers thinking about how we want to administer SNAP and implement it at the state level, it's an important thing to consider.
Okay. And Adrian, what about you? What are the policy implications of your research on the DEAR program?
So there are two main kind of policy implications that come to mind for my work. First, you know, from the individuals that we've been talking to, it's quite clear that these policies that kind of try to punish driving behaviors have a number of collateral consequences that are really meaningful for individuals' lives. And for this dissertation in particular, we're finding that there are a lot of implications around self-sufficiency. So for example, like many of our participants can detail experiences with career immobility and debt accumulation in particular. So folks are finding difficulty accessing certain types of jobs, or perhaps jobs that pay a living wage or a wage that would allow them to comfortably care for them and their families. And then oftentimes the license suspension piece comes with a fine or a fee that sometimes folks aren't able to pay. And because they're still living and still driving with this suspended license, it results in this kind of pattern of an accumulation of traffic tickets, which in turn is an accumulation of fines and fees. And we see some folks collecting debt that they are just unfortunately unable to escape from. And that debt sometimes can linger for years on end. So we're, you know, really learning some of that information from our folks. And I think we're also seeing that these experiences aren't concentrated just in the lives of unlicensed individuals, but they also have ramifications for the folks who are closest to them, their families, their friends, and also other folks in their networks as well. I think the other really important policy implication of this work is that this gives us another lens through which we might think about racial inequalities or racial disparities, particularly with economic inequality. So if we're thinking about literature that talks to us about how sometimes Black and Brown communities can experience higher rates of policing, they might experience higher rates of traffic stops, and sometimes those traffic stops resulting in a ticket or a citation or some type of monetary sanction. And also some of the literature that talks about kind of the existing disparities in income and wealth inequality already. If we then think about how some of those folks may be involved in this system of traffic infractions, we can see another way in which minoritized folks who might already be experiencing some of these disparities, you know, that disparity may be further exacerbated, right? Traffic tickets are one of those things that we tend to think of as kind of innocuous, like they're annoying, nobody likes them, but they don't mean that much. And what we're actually finding through our research is that that's not true, particularly for folks with low incomes, for whom these fines and fees may be a significant barrier to getting that license back.
Jen, let's turn to you now. Let's talk about the policy context and policy implications of your research on bone health.
So there's two specific areas. The first area is bills in House and Senate. And then the second area is looking at United States Preventative Service Task Force recommendations for osteoporosis. So when talking about bills in the House and Senate, since 1970s, approximately like 30 bills that are focused on increasing the screening, treatment, diagnostic rates of osteoporosis among older adults have been introduced, and none of them have really passed. The only measure that actually passed into law was creating a like National Osteoporosis Awareness Day. So that's one area that if we're talking about health disparities, as this is a very topical area, that hopefully it will create more momentum for those kinds of bills that are introduced. Currently, there's the Bone Health Act, which is in the House and the Senate. So maybe there'll be some forward action there. And then the second area is the United States Preventative Service Task Force recommendations. Currently, they rate the screening and treatment measures and as well as using medications after a fracture occurs, which is what results from osteoporosis. they rate them very low. So they say that there's not enough evidence, and then the recommendations that they provide for clinicians when to screen and treat don't include things like social and structural determinants of bone health, which we're seeing are things that are increasing people's risk. Yet the guidance doesn't even include these information or talk about how those factors should be assessed for clinicians. So those are two areas.
Okay. And that is a new phrase I just learned. So I've heard of social and structural determinants of health, but not of bone health. But that's interesting. So you can get even more specific about social determinants of a specific subsection of someone's health. Sorry, was there something else you were going to say there?
Only that there's a really lovely book about the determinants of bone health. It's called The Social Mosaic Bone Health.
Oh, okay.
It talks all about how, and like even in prehistoric times, looking at where people are buried in terms of like their class and even like their race, if they were slaves in certain countries, they look at their bone health and see that. And so taking things like that and applying it into the current day, how does like class, race, and social factors determine bone health? That's kind of where that term is, I guess, a little unique, just adding more specificity to it than broadly speaking about health.
Fascinating. Okay. That's a nice title for a book too. Is that Bone Health Act that you mentioned, is that something that has bipartisan support? Like how likely is it to pass, or do you have a sense of, yeah, like how broadly popular it is in Congress?
It is very similar to a bill, I think, that was introduced originally in the 90s. And so it's just a revised version of it. It's an expansion of certain Medicare services in terms of preventative care. And so I think that it has bipartisan support. It's just that there's so many other things that take priority sometimes over this. And that's something that's common for osteoporosis in general. It's a very like silent disease. Mm. So you don't know that your bones are maybe potentially becoming weaker over time as you're losing bone mass until this sentinel event, a bone fracture, occurs. But we see after those bone fractures occur, so many other negative things happen. So it's not getting enough attention, more so than I think like the support. Like, you know, if we think about cancer, people have so much information about it, but how many of you knew about what osteoporosis was or bone health before today, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's probably not leading the front page of the New York Times regularly. Okay. And then a lot of our listeners are probably going to be people who are interested in becoming summer fellows themselves, either in 2023 or future years. So I think listeners would probably be interested to know a little bit more about what that experience was like and what you got out of it. So if you don't mind, Katie, we'll start with you. Who'd you work with? What was that experience like, and what did you get out of it?
Yeah, so I primarily worked on this project with James Mabley, and it was a real privilege to get to work with him. I'd cited his work previously in my papers. He's done some really fascinating studies on early SNAP entrance and psychological distress. So it really felt like a privilege to get to work with such an expert in SNAP policy. And in addition to working with James, I also got to work with people from a number of different disciplines, you know, psychology, economics, people who are really, really strong in methods. So I think overall, the benefit of participating in this program over the summer was really expanding the scope of how I was thinking about this question and what data sources I was thinking about using and how I was thinking about answering it. Because I got to leverage people from so many different backgrounds and disciplines rather than just my sort of niche policy area and the world I come from and how I've been trained.
Yeah, so you could talk a little bit more about that. What is different about the kind of research that you do in this organizational setting versus in other settings in academia?
Yeah, I think there were a number of differences. I think one thing that stands out is, especially because I'm not a psychologist, I'm not trained in psychology, getting to talk with some of the psychology experts at Mathematica really emphasized to me the importance of measurement. That's not something we focus on as much in policy research typically, but really, so I ended up switching the entire data set I was using because I basically talked to someone who was like, hey, this like measure of mental health isn't really an established valid tool for assessing anxiety, depression. Like, you need to rethink that. So I think that's something that you're less concerned about sometimes in academia, because you're more concerned about, am I, is my identification strategy for getting at the causal effect really airtight, rather than like, hey, what am I even measuring? And how does this compare to other outcomes we're interested in? So I think taking a step back and thinking about it a little bit more broadly was really, really helpful.
Jen, I saw you nodding your head. It seems like what Kitty was saying resonated with you about revisiting a data set, or was there something similar about your experience at Mathematica?
Just a common experience in the doctoral process, more so than specifically at Mathematica.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, what was your experience like during the summer fellowship, and what were some of the concrete, I don't know, what did you get out of it, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. So when thinking about applying for this fellowship and the work that I was hoping to do and then eventually did as a summer fellow, I recognize that on my committee, I have biostatisticians, epidemiologists, and a sociologist. But for my third aim of my dissertation, I was wanting to survey providers and look at implicit racial bias, as well as just how they make screening and treatment decisions in this disease paradigm. And so I saw that Mathematica had several large projects with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where they developed provider surveys. And I had the honor of working with the survey research team, specifically Geraldine Hale and Barbara Carlson, on how to take my survey measure, which was not a validated survey measure, and move it more towards a validated measure, in addition to coming up with a sampling plan. So which providers was I going to recruit from what areas of the nation so that my results will hopefully be generalizable on this more national aspect than specific to just the state of Maryland, or what's called convenient sampling. So whoever conveniently sees my posting about responding to the survey then responds to it. So that was a lot of lift because I'm not a survey methodologist, and I got to learn so much about survey methodology, as well as like how the effect of this design influences some of my interpretations of results and statistical analysis. And it's very different from what I do on a daily basis, which is more like epidemiological research or behavioral intervention research. And so very different design aspect in terms of that.
Okay, great. And Adrian, what about you? You've actually been at Mathematica before, but even still, what was it like to come back here? What was the experience coming back as a summer fellow? Who did you work with? And what were the benefits of being a summer fellow?
So this summer, I was paired with Jill Stein as my buddy. And Jill and I had actually worked together previously when I was at Mathematica several years back. So it was really nice to kind of close the loop, so to speak, again. But she was a really useful resource, just kind of as someone who has some expertise in topics around like employment and labor. And she does have some interest in kind of the intersection of the criminal legal system as well. So just having someone who has that experience was really useful to just be able to talk through some high level ideas about my project and what I was learning from that kind of initial round of data analysis. But I think she was also really helpful with getting me connected with other folks and other resources at Mathematica. So during my time there previously, I did a good amount of quantitative work, so kind of data coding and that type of thing. And since I've been in my PhD program, I have gravitated more towards qualitative research questions and qualitative methods to answer those questions. So that's not something that I did when I was at Mathematica. So she really helped me to identify folks who were doing similar kind of work at Mathematica now, to learn more about the types of projects that they're working on, the types of methods that they are using, and what qualitative methods looks like in more of an applied research setting outside of the academy.
Okay. The last thing I wanted to talk about was, where do you go from here? What's next in your academic careers, and what's next in your careers more generally? We're well past last summer. So yeah, tell me a little bit about what, to the extent that you know, what's next, what are you planning? And why don't we start with Adrian, and then we'll go Katie and finish up with Jen.
So very near future, writing is the thing that I'm going to be doing. So I've been having some very useful, but also difficult to hear conversations with my advisors about the next 6 months and how I've really got to kind of buckle down and grind it out, you know, and there's no way around it. Wrestling with my ideas, putting some of these ideas on paper and getting some drafts for my committee to review is what I will be doing in the near future. Because next year will be my sixth and final year. So I will be exploring job options and refining a dissertation that I hope to be turning over to the graduate school for consideration about a year from now, which is really exciting. And then thinking about career opportunities, I'm exploring a wide range of career opportunities from more applied research to academic jobs, government, and everything in between. And what I'm finding is that I like this work, and I think this work is really important, and I want to keep working on this topic and related topics in my career. So an opportunity that allows me to do that, and an opportunity that allows me to teach and to share my knowledge are the two things that are most important to me. And I think I can do those things in a variety of places, but just identifying the opportunities that feel like a good fit, that allow me to continue developing my content skills, my methodological skills in the areas that I've really been enjoying since I've been in grad school, and outlets to continue sharing that information with folks, I think would be a good fit for me.
Katie, what's next for you?
Yeah, so I can go back a little bit to the summer, even though it seems so long ago now. But one of the, I think, advantages of doing the fellowship was getting to present at the end of the summer to a broad Mathematica audience that wasn't just SNAP experts or nutrition people. And so from that presentation, I walked away with so many questions from people about, hey, how do school closures interact with the SNAP policy change? How does unemployment insurance expansion interact with the SNAP policy change? So I think broadly for this project and for some of my other dissertation research, I'm really interested in diving into how the social safety net operates as a whole. How do these programs interact with each other? And asking questions of a little bit more broad scope like that. I guess directly, I have about a year and a half left for my PhD training. And so I'll defend my dissertation about a year and a half, which is, feels like a long way off, but I'm sure it'll quickly approach. And similar to Jen, I'm really interested in doing applied research for an organization like Mathematica, where I can work not just on SNAP, but on other sort of policy issues related to family well-being and inequality.
Okay, excellent. Jen, I want to turn to you.
What's next for me? Defending my dissertation and writing up papers is the first answer, but I think you're looking for a slightly more long-term answer. So I would love to work for some organization like Mathematica or for Mathematica doing health policy research, looking at this unequal care that we currently are seeing in this country. So a lot of structural factors like what's called de jure or de facto segregation. So although no longer do we like have segregation in this country, it's that people have settled in a certain region or certain areas. And so sometimes there's not as many services available for people in those areas or access to quality healthcare, because a provider or anybody, an individual, when they're deciding where to settle for their career, might make that decision based on like the structure and like poverty or things like that. So lack of access and care. Mathematica is one place that does that. And so that's where I'd like to start my career. But maybe in about 10 years, I would love to go do research on aging in the Caribbean and looking at all aspects of wellness. So mental health, physical health, and nutritional health. That would be the ultimate goal. And I see working in policy research as being the way to like slowly move towards doing that.
Okay, wait, and maybe I missed this earlier, but why in the Caribbean?
My family is originally from Puerto Rico, okay. And I see it as a way as like paying it forward or paying it backwards to like my family and my family roots, especially since there's not as much funding out there and they're consistently hit with, you know, harsh hurricane weather. And a lot of older adults live in Puerto Rico specifically. It's slightly higher proportion than to the average population of Hispanic individuals in the U.S., but so fewer services are available there than in the like 50 states.
Okay. So there are both kind of personal historical reasons why you would be interested in that area, but also it sounds like a really fascinating region or area for the policy questions and the health questions that you're exploring. Okay. And then I said that was my last question, but there's always one more I like to ask, which is, what am I forgetting to ask? Is there something specific about the summer fellowship program I failed to ask about that you think listeners should know?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
The culture of working at a place like Mathematica or experiencing the staff at Mathematica. So not only was it an extremely like positive experience, but I think sometimes when in graduate school, there's this very mentorship model. And depending on who your mentor is and just like how you interact in that environment, a lot of time it's like knowledge is being handed to you to suss out and disentangle these relationships for real discovery. And so you're in almost like an apprenticeship position versus a summer fellow at Mathematica, it was really encouraging and almost like a refreshing change in atmosphere to where when I brought in my research ideas, they were like, how can we improve your research? Let's like expand this. These are the ways that we can contribute to it. So seeing how communication and just how Mathematica's approach to research and community when it comes to like balancing life, work, research interest was really great, because if I start out in aging research, but I have multiple interests, it seemed like Mathematica allowed for you to have your primary research area or interest area, but then expand other areas as you got more comfortable. And I think they called it skilled up into the different domains or projects. So sometimes we're so siloed into one area in academia, and I've always considered myself like a jack of all trades or a gen of all trades, as in there's so many things I'm interested in. It's been hard to narrow it down to one, but at Mathematica, I wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think collaboration was really important and something that was quite evident. I think the thing that was most useful is being able to talk to folks who aren't familiar with this project. So folks having fresh eyes and people asking me some really, really smart and thoughtful questions and that pushed me, but also encouraged me to keep moving forward with this work. And I think that was really instrumental to moving this work forward, particularly for PhD students who may be in more, you know, traditional schools or traditional departments and who aren't sure about what research can look like outside of the academy. I think something like the Summer Fellowship is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity because there are folks who are doing good work in all types of industries, and sometimes we just aren't exposed to that. And I think an opportunity like this really helps to open the possibilities of what we can do with our knowledge and with our skill set, even if we choose not to look at those academic jobs.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your experiences about the Summer Fellowship Program. And I wish you all luck in the next stages in your careers.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to my guests, Jen Kirk, Katie Engel, and Adrian Jones. Applications for Mathematica's 2023 Summer Fellowship Program are due on February 28th, 2023. As a reminder, a full transcript of the episode is available in our show notes and on a blog at mathematica.org. My colleague, the inimitable Rick Stoddard, produced this episode. I also want to thank you for listening to another episode of On the Evidence, the Mathematica podcast. Stay up to date on future episodes by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts, or follow us on social media. Mathematica is on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.